their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
It's good to have everyone back with us this week. We're getting close to our trip. In fact, by the time you hear this, we'll probably be on our trip.
We will.
Heading out to Portland.
Yeah.
This will be, I don't know about you, but I have not set foot in an airport since the first week of March last year. I have not flown.
The last time, it's been even longer for me. The last time I was in an airport was like December of 2019.
Okay.
Which is astonishing for me.
I took three trips at the very beginning of last year, one workshop and then two personal trips. Mm-hmm. And I got back from that second one and then everything kind of, that's when all hell broke loose. It was... Mm-hmm. We were wondering on that flight, we were wiping everything down. Everyone was a little, this was like the very first week of March because no one was exactly sure what was happening. But happy to say that we'll be doing things again and we have appropriate PPE and all the necessary vaccinations. So I'm feeling pretty good about traveling.
Now, one thing related to that, and I think we mentioned this last week, because of our workshop, we're going to take a 1 week hiatus on podcast, so we will not have one out next week. It'll be out the week after that, and we'll put a reminder out on our Facebook page.
I'm sure we will miss our listeners more than they miss us, but
I suspect that's true.
That's how it goes.
But we'll be having fun on a workshop, so I think
that's right. So we'll neener, we're using our camera.
It'll be good.
So today we're gonna. It's going to be kind of a fun topic. We've kind of been brainstorming since last night and this morning about some of our sort of kind of like top 10 stuff, if you will, but the favorite advances in imaging technology over the last, however, since we've been doing this, that we really find useful and we're looking back on things from the older times, not just film, but even early digital, how far things have come and things that we were not even necessarily sure we would ever need. And yet now we find them indispensable.
Yeah. So they're kind of like our top 10 list of innovations that we really appreciate.
Exactly.
Now, before that, we're going to do a little short Lightroom tip.
Yeah.
Catalog usage, right?
Right. And we'll keep it pretty short, but the idea is, sometimes you might want to have more than one Lightroom catalog, and Lightroom can obviously only open one catalog at a time. And to open a new catalog or to open a different catalog, you've got to go through the motions of open this, it's got to close out its catalog and then open the new one. And then when you, depending on how you have Lightroom set up, the next time you launch Lightroom, sometimes it'll open to the catalog you've defined. As a default, other times you might have it set so it opens up to the last catalog you were in, and it can kind of get annoying. But the question before we go into the real easy tip for managing that, or at least something that I find to be kind of clever, why would you want more than one Lightroom catalog? That's a good question.
And what do we use? So like in my case, normally I just use one catalog for all of my images. However, on a trip like this where we're going on the workshop, one of the things I like to have during the workshop, especially since we'll be doing teaching and things like that, is a nice clean catalog. None of my other images from home and family and other shoots and things like that, just the Oregon workshops that we're doing, and that's it. And it just makes it simpler. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just a little bit more professional, I think. And so, the other day I created a new blank one to use for this trip, got it set up, named, all that kind of stuff. And that will be nice.
And when you get back home, you'll just import that catalog into your main catalog.
Into the primary. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Very simple. And then you don't get all those messages about missing disks because you're not attached to a drive back home
right.
and all these other things. That's a good, in fact, I may end up doing something similar like that, just depending on what we want to do. And we should point out too, there's really old advice. Really old advice. You know, we talk about things that are like outdated and you shouldn't follow this advice anymore. This is one of those things, which is, oh, you shouldn't have more than certain number of images in your Lightroom catalog. You should make a new Lightroom catalog for every year. Oh my God, you will kill yourself. You will drive yourself absolutely insane and there's no need for it anymore.
And you'll lose some of the benefits, you know, of being able to search across
exactly
the, you know, all of your images for certain things and groupings and so you lose a lot of the features.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know some people that, you know, for the professional work that they do create like Lightroom catalogs for each client, but it's pretty much the kind of thing that we were just talking about.
Right.
Let's say they're a wedding photographer or they do couples portraits or whatever. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they will use Lightroom to show their clients the images. And again, it's just nice to have that clean environment, not accidentally
right.
showing someone other, some other customers and giving that perception that you don't care about customer privacy and things
exactly.
like that.
Yeah. And but, it's just the point here is that the concerns about performance with large catalogs shouldn't be are no longer there. It's just
a
non-issue
thing. Yeah.
I have like 90,000 images in my primary Lightroom catalog and it, you know,
yeah, I think 70,000.
It seems to function. I do prune things out of it. But why do we have separate catalogs? Well, it's for obvious reasons of partitioning. So
yep.
I have like three catalogs. I have my main one like you. I have one that I keep only my family photos in so that they're not coming up when I'm doing workshops and client meetings and other things. And then oftentimes when I'm working one-on-one with a client, I will use a second or a different catalog altogether, kind of like my sandbox catalog where I can have client images only because I don't need client images in my own Lightroom catalog. So I might import their photos and they're separate from everything else. So this is a partitioning scheme, not a performance improvement.
Right. Now you said you had a simple way of switching between them.
Yeah, it occurs to
me. Normally, which isn't hard, but.
No, it's not hard, but it's just one of those things. So it occurred to me that, you know, if I'm going to open a different catalog, 90% of the time, you know, it's my family photos because that's where I put certain pictures of things. And yeah, my Lightroom is set up by default. It always opens my default catalog, which is my primary catalog. So what did I do? I just took the, it occurred to me that if you go into your Lightroom folder, you know, where Lightroom, where your catalogs live, and you see you have, I have different folders, each one with a different LR cat file. That's the catalog itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one called, you know, Jason O'Dell Photography. I have one called Family Photos. I made an alias or shortcut, if you will, to the Family Photos catalog file. Because if you double click on an LR cat file, it opens Lightroom with that catalog. Go figure. So I said, well, I could take this to my advantage. And you can put it on your desktop, or I'm on a Mac. I put it in my dock. You could put it in your, you know, menu items of, you know, your favorites or whatever you want to do. And so when I want to open Family Photos, I just go over to my, instead of just launching Lightroom, I just launch Lightroom from that shortcut. And then the next time I launch Lightroom the normal way, it goes back to my regular catalog because I have my preferences set to always open when launching Lightroom directly, it opens a particular catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm opening Lightroom from a cat, instead of opening Lightroom, I'm opening a catalog in Lightroom. And that's just a little nuance there,
yeah,
but it works.
That's a good tip.
It's because, you know, like I said, I was feeling clever one day. So it was just there.
Every once in a while.
Every now and then I have one of those crazy moments, but, anyhow, let's move on to our main topic for today, which is the improvements, top 10 list of, what did you describe them?
Innovations.
Innovations. That's the word I was looking for. I need another cup of coffee. And we kind of were brainstorming this, and I'm sure our listeners probably have innovations that they think of that we'll have left off this list. This is not meant to be an exhaustive list. This is just meant to be things that we've seen these technologies evolve over time, and we really like them. they've really made our life better. So why don't we start off?
And these are not in a ranked order.
Yes, they're just lists.
We did not bother doing that, and I don't even know if we could, to be honest.
No, they're all very good.
Yeah.
So I think a really good one. We'll start with some early stuff. Let's do them kind of chronologically, and one of the early things that came around that really we almost take for granted now is innovations in image stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Nikon's VR, Canon's IS, these things came out. They started showing up in the late 90s, early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
and they typically were lens-based. So you had to have a lens system that would do that, and you had to, you know, get these lenses. Now you can have lens-based, but also body-based if you have certain cameras, like mirrorless cameras, mm-hmm. where you can either use one or more of those depending on how the design of the system is. I don't think I would buy another system that didn't have stabilization. I mean, I think it goes without saying they'll have them. I mean,
yeah.
But it's really, lens stabilization was very good. It's gotten better. It's like the big telephoto lenses. But now having in-body stabilization with mirrorless cameras is huge for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, it's not a replacement for a tripod, but boy, does it extend the range of conditions that you can shoot in and just take shots easily that in the past would have been difficult.
Well, just think about it in terms of indoor shooting when traveling in tourist areas where tripods straight up aren't allowed.
Yeah. Or you're out on able a to have that street corner and, you know, I've shot images on busy city streets of, you know, with streaks from headlights and taillights and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what you can pull off at times, especially with the really good IBIS system and shorter focal lengths. But a side benefit of the stabilization stuff is it makes it easier to compose images with long lenses when you're hand holding them and keeping the focus point on the right thing, as opposed mm-hmm. to straying off of it and then
right.
losing lock. So there's some secondary benefits with it too. It's a nice, very useful technology.
Right. And I would go so far to say that one overlooked thing is that with systems that do have in-body stabilization, IBIS,
mm-hmm.
it allows the manufacturers to design lenses without stabilization systems in the lens and still benefit from the stabilization system
sure.
in the camera. And a lot of times that leads to better optical performance.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a cool
especially
thing.
Especially with some of the faster lenses, yeah.
Right, so you can make these new lenses, they don't need to have stabilization on the shorter focal lengths because the body is able to handle that.
Yeah.
So I think it's that to me has been a huge, huge improvement. And just something that I would just never want to lose again.
Right. I think trying to do this chronologically, I think we're going to give up on that here soon. One that I would put out there is just the ease of editing raw images.
Yes.
And what you can do and the power with them too. You know, when I first started working with raw files, which I think was back in 2002, I immediately saw the benefits and everything. I wasn't someone who needed to be converted from JPEGs.
Mm-hmm.
I went to it virtually immediately, but the tools were really clunky. They weren't very quick. It was very much a one image at a time thing. No local adjustments, no color profiles, all sorts of things that we take for granted now. So that whole expansion of what raw editors can do for you has been just a wonderful thing.
I agree. I mean, you went from a tool that was sort of a one-trick pony. It basically existed in the early days to convert the file into a TIFF type of format, or, you know, which is why they were called raw converters. It was to decode the file so that you could give it to something like Photoshop or where to actually do the bulk of your work in. And, you know, yeah, you could change exposure and you could change white balance, and those were great things, but it was a very limited tool set. You did it because you knew you had that available to you. And so, you know, there was certainly a debate, RAW versus JPEG, more back then, because, you know, it did add extra overhead to your workflow. Now it's almost goes without saying, why wouldn't you shoot RAW? Because every tool that we've tried gives you so much power over what you can do, to the point where sometimes you almost don't even need to go into a pixel editor like Photoshop to finish your picture. Right. There's plenty of examples where you can do everything in your RAW tool in a non-destructive way on a smaller file size. So
yeah,
it's really great.
Yeah. All right. So next, trying to see if there's an obvious. Well, I think we start getting into higher resolution digital imaging.
Yeah, there's kind of two here that go together.
Yeah.
The megapixel race.
Super high. Just reasonable, like 24.
Right. Megapixel. I mean, for the longest time, you know, it was a megapixel. Oh, you have this many megapixels, and that, you know, whatever. But the fact that right now most digital cameras will deliver 20 to 24 megapixels at the minimum is outstanding. You know, that we have that. And of course, you can always have options that give you more, oftentimes for more money. But there, you know, it's not like my digital images when I look back to my 12 megapixel files, because that's where I started. And I know you started with even fewer megapixels.
Six and four.
Right. I mean, D2H, you know, megapixels, right? Those are actually quite good. And I think we didn't give them the credit that they deserved at the time. Because I think back then we were still lingering on, you know, latching onto this idea that, well, film is probably still more if you do a good film scan. Mm-hmm. And that was erroneous information. That was a fallacy, unfortunately. There was a fallacy that suggested that until you had 24 megapixels, you weren't beating 35 millimeter slide film. And that paradigm is completely wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah.
We both saw that because we both had film scanners. We scan slide film. But now with 24 and up, the ability to just crop and get detail, you know, to the level that you would have needed medium format types of film cameras,
glorious looking large prints. It's just so nice.
It really is.
I would never want to go back. So to me, that was, you know, a good one to have on the list.
And it's not, I would just throw in, it's not just having the pixels, but good quality megapixels we're talking about here. You know, that it wasn't always the case, just cramming things onto tiny sensors. You can, you know, do things. But the one that's kind of related to this was when all of a sudden the noise performance of sensor technology hit that mark where all of a sudden ISO 1600 was just middle of the ISO range, high ISO shooting. And, you know, we both saw this with the D3 when it came out. Where all of a sudden, I remember we interviewed Dave Black, or no, I did, but we had Dave Black on the show, Nikon ambassador, sports photographer. And, you know, we were talking about the D3 had just come out. So this is like, what, 2008, somewhere in there. And just the number of possibilities that being able to go into and shoot at those ISOs opens up is crazy.
Yeah, I remember, you know, my son and I being on a trip to Eastern Europe right before that. And I was shooting with a little D200, which was a nice camera. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that great at high ISOs. And I remember we were in a crypt area and stuff. It was kind of cool in terms of the things in there. And I was having to shoot at ISO 1600. And I got home and, oh my gosh, they were just trash the time, you know, horrible grain, weird color banding in the image and stuff like that. And actually I can fix a lot of that now with today's tools, but yeah, it's still not gonna be that great. But when the D3 and beyond showed up, oh my gosh,
yeah, just
extraordinary.
Still ISO 6400 is not to be shied away from anymore with most cameras. Even the higher megapixel ones. I mean, I've routinely shot 8,000 ISO with D850, Z7, and you know, yeah, there's a little bit of noise there if I crop way in, but I can usually clean it up. And when you couple that with our earlier mention of stabilization, so now you've got image stabilization as well as being able to use higher ISO. So you might be indoors able to shoot at a 15th or a 30th of a second handheld, and you don't need to use a crazy ISO to get those kinds of, you know, you can use a higher ISO and still get great images. That would be even better because you can shoot at a slightly faster, higher speed, shutter speed, and you couple that with your stabilization and you're in great shape. I mean, I think about when I took my clients to Paris, and we went to the Chapel Sainte-Chapelle.
Beautiful.
It's just some of the best stained glass windows you will ever see in your
life.
It's insane. But, you know, in there, it's kind of crowded and it's all, you know, there's no tripods. It's all handheld, everything. And so, yeah, it was great. I could just shoot stabilized and it was wonderful.
Yeah. I think the next one, and I'm still going chronologically.
Okay.
Infrared conversion.
Oh, yeah.
Of bodies. You know, I always thought infrared was cool. I remember seeing the results from infrared film when I was young, you know, like teenager at the most, and more like junior high. Just thought it was very cool, but it was so difficult to work with. I never did. Infrared film was just a bit of a beast to handle.
Almost impossible.
Yeah. And then there was the option of infrared filters, which you could use with DSLRs. And that was a huge step forward, but you were still stuck with very long exposure. So you had to use a tripod and, you know, really couldn't do much with subjects that were moving or look bad. But then when the option of getting your older body converted to infrared came up, oh my gosh, it just opened up a whole area. And I know both of us enjoyed a lot. We might be doing an infrared workshop in Oregon in about a week.
We might have to do some more.
Yeah, I think we will. But it is such a cool thing and it's gotten so easy. And it's just a really nice option.
It's just accessible now in a way that it never would have been before. It was just infrared is just one of those foreign things. Like it was cool, but then you looked at what you had to do to get it with using infrared film that was heat sensitive, that you had to load in the dark. I mean, just all kinds of crazy things in order for that to happen. And, you know, an infrared conversion these days is usually about $300, give or take. That's very much in the affordable realm for most enthusiasts. To give it a try, and you just get some really amazing.
And there's value in it in terms of the creative doors it opens.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely get a lot for that money.
Yeah, it's just something I don't think in the film days I would have even considered doing unless I took like a specific class at where they did that. Right. And even then it would have been like a one-off, right? It wouldn't have been something you would have had normally. So that's very cool.
EVF. What do you?
Yeah, I was absolutely going there. Electronic viewfinders, which really, you know, we're talking about mirrorless cameras, sort of in general. But so cameras with electronic viewfinders, so mirrorless cameras. That's a huge thing because it has made the shooting experience far easier to perform. Like it makes taking photos more enjoyable because you have access to more information without having to take your eye away from the camera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a great thing. And EVFs have gotten so much better. I mean, the early ones were really not fun to use.
Yeah, I used mirrorless cameras at a very early point. You know, when I had a Panasonic G1, I think, which had a very low resolution EVF, and it worked, but quite honestly, it was sort of an awful experience.
Yeah, right.
But they quickly improved, and they are so nice. And you've got the option of seeing the effects of color or black and white profiles at the time you're shooting, all sorts of things.
Now, I mean, now DSLR users could do this with the advent of live view, which also came around about that same time as the D3, because they put video. They started putting video into DSLRs. Mm-hmm. Canon was doing that early, and you know, Sony's well known for having good video. But the ergonomics of that is a real pain if you're trying to shoot anything other than a tripod mode, because you have to use the rear LCD, and you're now holding this rig, and it's not, you know, your camera is meant to be stabilized by holding it up to your eye. So EVF.
Although I am amazed at how many people shoot that way deliberately. Okay. I think there are, you know, we can talk about that sometime. I don't do it, but I think there is an argument for it, and we can talk about it one-on-one, and then
I'm gonna write people up tickets.
Have a secret conversation about it, and then
there you go. All right. But I think being able to put your eye up to the viewfinder and not only get access to all that information, but see the exposure preview, the color preview, as well as being able to shoot video that way. Yeah. With mirrorless cameras is a tremendous thing. And then a corollary to this, which is also something that you can get in live view, but it, again, is easier with an EVF, was when camera manufacturers started implementing a live histogram, which is tremendous. I started using a live histogram with my DSLRs when it started showing up, you know, the D8. 100 series, and you realize that it's there. And for tripod shooting, for landscapes, that kind of stuff, that's the only way I go. Because I can just adjust my exposure using a histogram preview and not have to guess anymore.
Yeah, we've gone through successive generations where the guessing disappeared out of photography, going to digital imaging. Being able to see results quickly was one of them. The EVF and live histogram, absolutely some other major steps, really nice.
So it takes the iterative and guesswork and the iterative process out of that. Because before it would be like, well, it looks a little underexposed. Maybe I'll dial in plus 2/3 of a stop, and let me take that photo and see how it comes out. Okay, is the histogram where I want it? In the meantime, your subject has changed because the light's now different, right? Now you just look at it on the screen, whether it's on your LCD or through an EVF, and there's your histogram. You just dial in the exposure adjustments as needed and click, one shot.
Yeah. One that I like that's evolved a lot over the last few years is face and eye detection autofocus.
Yeah, very cool.
I'm not of the school that it's a gimmick. I think it's a wonderful feature, especially if it's implemented well. And the thing I like about it is it really allows you to focus more on the composition and not worry about whether or not you've got your autofocus sensor point over exactly the right place. Or is it going to result in an out-of-focus image on the eye? It just takes care of that for you, and you can pay attention to the composition, what your subject's doing, talk to your subject, all sorts of things. And with it moving more into the realm of animal eye detect too, it simplifies that whole process as well. So it's a really nice one. It's going to continue to mature, but I think there are a lot of benefits with it. It's not trivial.
I agree with you. I think when it first came out, it was like, well, you know, the technology has been there. Like, I mean, Nikon actually uses face detection in its DSLRs. If you use, you know, auto area focus mode, it tries to find faces, but you don't get that feedback on knowing what the camera is looking at necessarily until you get your shot back and review it. So the technology is there, but I really think, I think both of us think that it's features like that that are going to be the real discriminators in terms of which brand, you know, which, you know, who can deliver that technology best to really appeal to certain subsets of photographers. You know, all the cameras have decent autofocus systems these days. All the cameras have excellent sensors. So it's going to be things like, you know, animal or face detection or whatever that really set certain cameras apart. You know, and I think that's hopefully where the R&D is going. Because I know you've been talking about eye detection options for a long, way before it even existed. You talked mm-hmm. about the possibility of that. Mm-hmm. I remember us having conversations a long time ago.
Yeah.
So that was cool. Okay, we're coming down to the end of our list. What else? Oh, two other things. One is the phase Fresnel lens technology.
Mm-hmm. Or diffractive optics is another name.
Right. Diffractive optics that Canon uses, PF if you're Nikon. This is really cool stuff.
Yeah. You know, both of us have the 300 and the 500 PF lenses, which are just tiny compared to their conventional counterparts. Just tiny. And the weight is so much lower. They're so much easier to handle, to handhold, to pack on a trip. Mm-hmm. My gosh.
Well,
great stuff.
You wouldn't handhold a 500, but for certain scenarios, a 500 F4.
Mm-hmm.
And even a lens like the 200 to 500 is a heavy thing. It's 5 pounds. The 500 millimeter 5.6 PF Nikkor lens is like 3 pounds. And as we mentioned in our review, when we first got these, we did a review away a while back now, it's kind of like handling a 70 to 200 2.8, mm-hmm. which is, yeah, a heavy lens, but not unmanageable heavy. It's just, it's a bigger lens.
But you can be so much more mobile in your shooting. It's,
yes.
There are just so many nice things about it. So cool technology. Let's see more.
Yeah. And they're sharp wide open too. So nice designs.
Yeah.
And then, what's the last one on our list here, Rick?
The last one I have is autofocus bracketing.
Yeah,
that's cool. Where you can have the camera shoot a sequence of shots starting at one distance and ending at another one, or ending until you know, after a certain number of shots, and then you stitch them together and get increased depth of field. It's just such a nice technology. And for me, it ended up making me decide to sell my tilt shift lenses, because I mainly use those as a tool for getting increased depth of field, especially mm-hmm. with higher resolution bodies. I wasn't needing them as much for perspective correction, but it's just so easy to do the focus bracketing. It doesn't work for every shot, but it works for a lot of them, and it's great.
Yeah, I remember getting an email from a friend a long, long time ago, like 2006 or something, telling me about, hey, check out this Helicon focus program, which still is around and is actually very good. It's mature.
Yeah, it is.
The concept of focus stacking has been around for over a decade. It's been around for a long time. But now we're getting automation in our cameras that make it not only easier, but you get better results because the spacing is uniform. The camera is doing that work for you. You set it up, you push a button, it runs off its sequence, and then you've got it, and you can just process them later. It's you don't really have to think as hard.
And I think we'll still see some more updates to that, which will make it even friendlier, like the new GFX 100S, you know, Fuji that I have, medium format. The way you have the option of the old style, like we were kind of alluding to, starting point, certain number of shots, whatever, but and also some threshold on how small of steps you want. Or you can just say, here's my closest point, bang, here's my most distant point that I want in focus, bang, take the shots for me.
There you go. That's awesome.
It does everything else. It is awesome, and it works really well.
Yeah, so that's cool stuff, and I'm sure we'll we'll get a chance to practice a little of that in Oregon this mm-hmm. coming week, as well as in Colorado when we do our wildflower workshop, because that's going to be an excellent place to play around with focus stacking and learning it. But I think if you, well, that's our list. I'm sure, you know, there's other things we could have put on here, but we'd love to hear from our listeners as to what might be their favorite technological improvement over the years, or innovation, if you will. You can do that by dropping us a note over on our Facebook page, facebook.com/imagedoctors. And until next time, we hope to see you in the field. Happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.